It's Monday, April 12th, and I'm interviewing Dr. Mike Shelby of the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences.
All right, so I've turned the tape deck on, and you're aware that I'm taping. Yes?
I'm aware, yes.
Thank you.
I am being taped.
So, could we start by you telling me a bit about your educational background and your training in science?
Yeah, I was interested in science from junior high or high school. I've got a bachelor's degree in Central State College in Edmond, Oklahoma, after attending Oklahoma State University for 2.5 years. And I got a degree in biology and chemistry. Worked about 3 years, including the last 2 years as a technician at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. And in a neurospora genetics lab there, most of that time was spent on the biosatellite program, so we were sending neurospora spores into outer space and then recovering them after the satellites came down, assessing radiation-induced mutations. After being there for a year or so, I came out of rural Oklahoma, so education and science were kind of far-fetched at the time for me. But I realized after a year or two at Oak Ridge that there were a lot of PhDs out there, and some of them were a lot smarter than me, and some of them were not as smart as I was. So I figured I could get a PhD too. So anyway, I started applying for grants to get into graduate school. I was married and got a fellowship at University of Tennessee, Knoxville, in the Department of Botany, interestingly enough, because they offered the best fellowship. But I continued working in neurospora genetics. Got my PhD there in 73. Went back and worked at Oak Ridge National Lab in something called the Environmental Mutagen Information Center. I started working there part-time while I was still in graduate school, and went back full-time when I graduated. Worked there for about 4 years and got tired of that work, and contacted NIEHS because there have been a lot of people that had moved from Oak Ridge. The biology division there was slowly shrinking, and NIEHS was growing, and the EPA over here was growing, so people were finding their way from East Tennessee to RTP. So I got on Fred DeSerre, who was the, I guess, associate director for genetics at NIEHS, who I had worked for in Oak Ridge, hired me over here. So I was just working in the front office, associate director for genetics office. Among other things, we ran three big international collaborative studies assessing the predictive value of short-term tests for chemical carcinogens. That was funded in large part by the WHO IPCS, International Program for Chemical Safety. And the books are on the shelf. They all got published in book form, all three studies. Then in about 81, I can't remember, the National Toxicology Program had come into existence. Ray Tennant had been hired out of Oak Ridge to come over here and head the CGTB, cellular and genetic toxicology branch. and he was looking for people. So I went to work, changed jobs within the Institute, and went to work for Ray at that time. And built up the mammalian cytogenetics and mammalian germ cell mutagenesis programs from scratch to a fairly large operation. It was all done by contract.
Okay.
So I was project officer on studies looking at cytogenetic effects in human lymphocytes, culture, and in vivo blood taken from donors. We have mouse bone marrow cytogenetic studies going on, and also built up a big germ cell mutagenesis program at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, again, to look at the potential of chemicals to induce heritable changes in the germ cells and lead to genetic disorders in subsequent generations. So I did that for several years. Some reorganizations occurred. I can't remember exactly what was happening at that point, but anyway, I ended up working for Bern Schwetz, who was basically got the same position that Chris Portier has now, mm-hmm. and that George Lucier had before that. Mm-hmm. And moved and spread out a bit into reproductive and developmental tox. Mm-hmm. Did that for a few years, then some more reorganizations occurred, and I was made chief of the laboratory of toxicology, mm-hmm. which I did for about 7 years. And in that time is the time that I set up the Center for Evaluation of Risks to Human Reproduction. Mm-hmm. And I volunteered to, if they wanted a new branch chief, that I would be happy to spend my full time working mm-hmm. on the center. And after a year or so, they decided that was a good idea. So. Mm-hmm.
How long has the center existed?
The center was established in 98, mm-hmm. officially. It took 2 or 3 years to get it to that point, mm-hmm. but it came into existence in June of 98, mm-hmm. so it's 6 years old now. Mm-hmm. So I've gone from genetic tox to reproductive and developmental tox. Mm-hmm. So that's where we are today.
Okay, now of course I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions
right.
about everything you just told me. When you were at Oak Ridge the first time working on Neurospora genetics,
right. mm-hmm.
whose lab was that?
Fred Desserre.
Desserre, who later came here.
Right.
Okay.
He came here in 72.
Okay. And then when you went back and you were working on the Environmental Mutagenesis Information Center, mm-hmm. who were your colleagues?
John Rossum.
Okay.
Elizabeth von Halley. Mm-hmm. And in the beginning, that was it. There were just three of us.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then we hired a few more people whose names I can't remember.
And where is that? Is that project ongoing? And if so, where is it located?
No, NIEHS was always the primary funder for it, and mm-hmm. a few years ago, so it was a database, a searchable database mm-hmm. of the literature, where we collected the literature, indexed it, mm-hmm. put it into computers, and did searches, published bibliographies, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. And the Institute here just decided it was no longer necessary. And I don't know when that was mm-hmm. 4 or 5 years ago, mm-hmm. that they cut the funding for it. So mm-hmm. I think it doesn't exist any longer.
Was it perceived as unnecessary because there's a comparable resource?
I think part of it was due to kind of a a declining interest in genetic toxicology.
We
had a big, we had a branch dedicated to genetic tox, essentially.
And that was
back in the early 80s, right, with Ray Tennant. And that no longer exists. There's just not much action in that area any longer. So,
and from your perspective, why is there not much action in that area anymore?
Well, I think the genetic tox sort of found its way into the fabric of toxicology, and the kinds of tests that are done, the way they're conducted, those things kind of got...
It's back on, and if you could pick up on the topic of why environmental mutagenesis and genetic toxicology have developed around a focus on screening and testing for mutagenicity and carcinogenicity of chemicals.
So this goes back to the large number of chemicals that need to be evaluated for their potential carcinogenicity, and that number is in thousands, and the impossibility of doing that many tests in two-year rodent carcinogenicity studies. And not just because of the expense and the time required, but also because of our commitment to reducing, refining, replacing whole animal studies with other tests where possible. So there were a large number of chemicals to be tested, and there was a fairly sound mechanistic basis for using genetic tox tests to screen for carcinogens, because it's thought that, and there's a great deal of evidence, that, that some or many or most chemical-induced tumors result from from the DNA damage induced by those chemicals. So it was a practical reason and a scientific reason that that these short-term tests held a great deal of promise. So that's why so much effort was put into it. Then the reason there were so many tests being developed, which was the second part of it, is because the Ames test, as useful as it has been, left concern among many people that a bacterial cell could not reflect all the types of damage that might be induced in mammalian cells, which was the cell of concern. And so, as I told you earlier, there was a, it's a bit of a matrix, is the easiest way to think about it, of a variety of organisms down one axis, being bacteria, eukaryotic microbes such as yeast, cultured mammalian cells, whole animals, rats or mice, and the study of genetic damage induced in them, as well as cultured mammalian cells and the induction of gene mutations, which there were several different assays that were available with that endpoint, the HPRT mutations in a variety of cells, the thymidine kinase locus in L5178Y cells. So there were a variety of organisms available to investigate these effects, and there were a variety of genetic endpoints that need to be looked at, from base pair substitutions to frameshift mutations, small deletions, chromosome aberrations, aneuploidy or whole chromosome changes, and a great deal of activity over 15 or 20 years involved trying to figure out what combinations of organisms and endpoints as genetic tox tests, which of those could best be combined to predict potential carcinogenicity of a compound. And so much of CGTB's activities.
The cell genetics.
Cellular and genetic toxicology branch.
Okay.
Went into that effort, and in fact, we ended up publishing a paper in Science, which was kind of the culmination of our work in that area. And in the end, we kind of dropped back to using the Ames tests, stayed on board, and some measure of chromosome aberration damage in cultured cells and in intact laboratory animals. And I think I haven't worked in this area for 5 years or more in the Institute, but I think they're down to that they do Ames tests, some chromosome aberration tests in cultured Chinese hamster ovary cells, and in vivo they use mouse bone marrow micronucleus or peripheral blood micronucleus, mm-hmm. which is a surrogate for standard metaphase analysis of chromosome aberrations in animals. And so that's why a lot of the action has diminished, is because they've just kind of settled on a few tests that they're going to use. Mm-hmm. And the tests never did prove to be as predictive as people had hoped they would be.
Is that on their own or as compared to a 2-year rodent bioassay?
It's comparing it almost, okay. Yeah, to the results of the 2-year rodent bioassay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we just dropped back to 2 or 3 tests, and those are run fairly routinely on all the chemicals that come into the carcinogenesis bioassay program. And so all the hunting and searching is mm-hmm. and modifying protocols and looking for new organisms has kind of come to an end.
It seems like the transgenic mouse models were part of this trajectory of looking for different sorts of bioassays. Could you help me understand their relationship to research that had been done in this area?
Well, Ray Tennant's the best person to talk to you about those, or Ron Cannon, mm-hmm. or Jeff French.
I have talked to all three of them.
You have?
I have.
Already? Okay, then you've got more than I can tell you. I was never a great fan of the transgenics, so it's,
okay.
I mean, I understand how they work, and the basis is theoretically good.
May I ask you what kept you from being a fan?
They seem oversimplified to me, mm-hmm. that these are single gene changes in these mm-hmm. the two models that are most popular here at NIEHS. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they did hold the promise of allowing one to screen for induced tumors in a shorter period of time mm-hmm. with fewer animals, which mm-hmm. was a big step forward. But it never sat comfortably in my mind that these genetically modified mice would, specifically genetically modified in single gene sense, would be sufficiently predictive of what those chemicals would do in humans.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed an oversimplification to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I liked the fact that they were quick and,
mm-hmm.
and less expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like the fact that they were based on these single transgenes. Mm-hmm. That's all.
What are the full range of characteristics you look for in evaluating a bioassay?
I don't evaluate bioassays, and I haven't for years, but
mm-hmm. And what would you hope? What would a perfect tool do for you? You plural.
Right.
Well, it would accurately predict those chemicals with the potential to cause cancer in humans, mm-hmm. and they would do it quickly and inexpensively.
With few animals.
Right.
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 Okay.
I mean the human population is so genetically diverse, mm-hmm. and the animals that we use to study the induction of cancer are so genetically uniform, mm-hmm. that it's just difficult to know, to understand how they can be predictive of mm-hmm. cancer induction mm-hmm. in such a diverse population mm-hmm. as the human population.
Let me go back to a question about the history of genetic toxicology at the NIEHS. You've mentioned the cellular and genetic toxicology branch. Can you also just give me the names of the different labs or different branches where this research was most significantly undertaken?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the predecessor of the CGTB, whose name I can't remember, just one, Heinrich Malling can tell you that because mm-hmm. he was the chief of it for some period of time. A lot of it went on in the Carl Barrett's laboratory, mm-hmm. laboratory of carcinogenesis or laboratory of molecular carcinogenesis. I think those were probably the main places okay. where this work went on.
And then where did, part of what I'm trying to understand, I'll show you what I'm looking at, is how the laboratory of environmental carcinogenesis and mutagenesis was related to these others. And then my understanding is that this is basically the NTP.
Right.
So right?
Right.
So just again, trying to understand how the work in this area was divided across these different labs.
Well, it just kind of happened spontaneously. I'm not sure that there was any formal uh-huh. division of labor that went on. I mean, most of the intramural scientists have got a good deal of freedom in what they choose mm-hmm. to investigate. And so this is a current.
No, because
no, this is September.
No. And the Laboratory of Environmental Carcinogenesis and Mutagenesis no longer exists,
right?
And tenants with the National Center for Toxicogenomics.
Right.
And Barrett, of course, is at NCI now. I interviewed him, too. He's wonderful.
Okay. Good. So, I mean, some of the work, not much, still goes on here. I mean, most of the work now
in the Laboratory of Toxicology.
Right, is done by contract.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all of our testing is done, I guess all of the testing is done by contract.
Mm-hmm.
So we just send the chemicals to the labs and they send us the test results
mm-hmm.
back. And, you know, there's no true focus inside NIEHS mm-hmm. on this.
Okay.
You might want to talk to Christine Witt,
okay.
who is sort of the person that oversees all that now.
Okay.
And she's remained deeply involved in it for many years,
mm-hmm.
and she still is, and so she's got, her memory's got more continuity in this than mine. And she can fill you in on the details
okay.
of what's happened since whenever, 84 or something, when she came here.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. It's WITT?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Again, a general question. When you were working in the area of genetic toxicology at the Institute, how were resources allocated to those labs? Was there kind of a central plan for genetic toxicology, or was it more independent investigator-initiated research?
Oh, again, that was Ray Tennant's business at the time.
Okay.
I mean, if I had projects that I wanted to downscale or upscale or change, mm-hmm. I went to Ray with a plan, and mm-hmm. he said yes or no, or went mm-hmm. a step higher and find out whether or not we had the resources mm-hmm. to support it or not.
Now, Ray also came from Oak Ridge.
Yes.
But not from the Neurospora Genetics.
No, no, he was a viral oncologist.
Right. Okay.
Right? Yeah.
Were there ways in which those lines of research intersected?
If they are, they're fairly vague.
Okay.
But I mean, Ray's a very bright guy. He's a good. He provides good leadership. He's got a lot of vision, and he kind of flourish wherever he ends mm-hmm. up, I think. Mm-hmm. He's a good promoter and salesman.
Mm-hmm.
So, they did not bring him here to head that branch because of his genetic toxicology experience,
mm-hmm.
I don't think. But that he did a very good job just the same.
Mm-hmm.
Just based on general scientific knowledge and leadership skills,
mm-hmm.
I think.
Mm-hmm. In what ways have the relationships between Oak Ridge and NIEHS been maintained over time?
Well, we provided a lot of money to Oak Ridge. I can only speak what I was involved in, but at that time, 20 years ago, Julian Preston was still at Oak Ridge and world-class human cytogeneticist and did a lot of human cytogenetic studies for the program.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill and Lee Russell, Waldy Generoso and that group in the mammalian genetics program over there were our primary source of studies on germ cell mutagenesis. And so we put a lot of money into Oak Ridge for several years on both of those programs. I had an email recently from John Wasson saying that they were closing the last building at the biology division at Oak Ridge, so it no longer exists as
mm-hmm.
such. They've got a new mammalian genetics facility over at the X10 plant,
mm-hmm.
where we were all located at the Y12 facility. So it's finally petered out completely,
mm-hmm.
except for the mammalian mutagenesis studies.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a considerable amount of interaction, funding,
mm-hmm.
Visits, seminars back and forth between the two places.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've noticed in my reading is that the focus on genetics at Oak Ridge seemed to be on the damage to human genetic material caused by exogenous agents, whereas the focus at NIEHS seems to be both that and also questions of genetic susceptibility, genetic diversity. Has that been a shift that you've observed over time, or were those two genetic foci always present?
I think the latter one that you mentioned of variability and
mm-hmm.
Susceptible subpopulations is newer
mm-hmm.
than the old concern about simply the effects of chemicals on genetic material.
Mm-hmm.
And as understanding of human genetics and DNA repair processes and other, the genes that determine metabolism,
mm-hmm.
all these various genes that can impact susceptibility, as an understanding of those has grown, then so has the second area that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just a natural progression, I think,
mm-hmm.
Rather than any kind of a shift.
And one doesn't exclude the other in
no.
any way, correct?
No.
They can both be
absolutely
investigated.
Right.
together.
Mm-hmm.
And how do I want to ask this? Does susceptibility or questions of genetic susceptibility have a role in the testing and screening component of genetic toxicology or now environmental health more broadly?
At the moment, I can't see how it has a role in the screening.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me to be a step further down the line that once you can, through screening, determine the kinds of genetic
mm-hmm.
damage that may be induced by an environmental agent
mm-hmm.
and have some understanding of the mechanisms by which that occurs, then you can gain an appreciation for what variables,
mm-hmm.
what genetic variables might reduce or increase the susceptibility to that damage.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't consider it a part of the screening, not of the chemical screening,
mm-hmm.
but maybe the human screening to know what people's genetic makeup is and what insults they might want to be, might particularly want to avoid
mm-hmm.
you know, or be protected from. You know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah.
If you were to describe kind of the current state of genetic toxicology, how would you describe it?
I'm not in a very good position to, since I don't currently work in genetic tox.
Mm-hmm.
I'd have to, after 25 years as an insider, I have to look at it as an outsider now. That'll take some thought. And I suppose that that what we were just talking about is one of the areas that may be most active in the area of genetic tox now is genetic variability and the variation in susceptibility to genetic damage and how it's expressed as a genetic disease, whether it's a somatic disorder such as cancer or a heritable disorder that results from genetic damage to sperm or eggs. I mean, a lot of the emphasis in the Environmental Mutagen Society now is on it's on DNA repair, which is not a new field by any means, but one that in which the is much more strongly represented within the Environmental Mutagen Society and
mm-hmm.
the agenda of our annual meetings
mm-hmm.
and so forth, and the papers that appear in the journal.
Mm-hmm. Do you still go to the EMS meetings?
Right, I do.
Have they changed significantly over
they
time?
Yeah, they have. Yeah,
in
very,
what way?
Very much so. Well, from the just along the lines we've been talking about. I mean, when I first went in 1974, I mean, it was all about testing. And back then, I mean, the assays were different. There was a period of time when the host-mediated assay was popular,
mm-hmm.
and Drosophila was much more widely used in testing and screening. And those have kind of fallen into as areas of little interest in the screening field. And there was this big period of new assay development and the studies to try to determine the predictive values of the individual assays, the assays in various combinations, which lasted years and years. And now there are other interests. I mean, the whole genomics phenomenon, ability to sequence DNA, the mini satellite, microsatellite mutations are a big issue. DNA repair is as always, and perhaps more so today within the EMS, a topic of interest and substantial activity. So it has changed a lot.
This is a somewhat different topic, but in what ways is toxicogenomics, in what ways, if any, is toxicogenomics related to the research agenda that began in the EMS? Is there a relationship there, is probably the first question.
Well, I mean, if you could define what you mean by toxicogenomics, it might be easier, but I mean, it's, in my mind, it's the increases or decreases in transcription of specific genes that follow exposure to some external agent. And in that sense, it's not very closely, in my mind, related to genetic tox.
Where the focus was on genetic damage.
Right, the DNA, and this is expression of the genes. And I mean, those changes by no means require a change in the DNA.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's the expression machinery that's important there.
Mm-hmm.
So although there may be a relationship that I don't see, I'm not aware of it.
Mm-hmm. And again, another question about differentiating kind of areas of science. In what ways are genetic toxicology and environmental carcinogenesis similar or different emphases of study within the environmental health sciences?
Well, I mean, that I believe they are still very closely related and have been since the onset of the environmental mutagenesis field, because that's been a major public health concern, is cancer. I think, I don't keep up with the literature anymore, but I mean, you still see a world of papers coming out on the kinds of genetic damage that's found in specific genes, oncogenes or tumor suppressor genes in tumor tissues of humans and in animals. And I mean, that's all related to the kinds of damage, genetic damage, DNA damage that was induced and possibly led to the initiation of those tumors. And I mean, that's the very thing that the genetic tox people look at. Whereas the genetic tox people are characterizing the genetic effects of the chemical, cancer people are typically characterizing the kinds of genetic damage that occurs in the tumors or in pre-tumorous tissue without knowing what the chemical is that they were exposed to. So, yeah, so there again, it's a continuum, I think, of scientific events that are closely related and perhaps causally. In many situations.
Just a couple more questions. What are the biggest changes in science that you've observed over the course of your career?
The biggest change in science, of course.
Or the most significant?
Is probably the financial changes in it.
What do you mean?
I mean, patents and intellectual property and the fortunes that have been made on it, which was virtually unheard of when I first got into science. Just nobody even thought of it. I think it's probably funding, even though the funding is up, the difficulty of obtaining funding is probably greater than it was 20 or 25 years ago. There's relatively more scientists around, even though the pie is bigger. The number of people wanting a piece of that pie has also greatly increased.
What are the changes or developments that have been most significant to your work as a scientist?
Well, I mean, clearly, it's molecular biology, the capability and the technology to worm our way down closer and closer to the primary events that cause changes in biological systems. I'm not that old, but it was pretty crude in 1970 what we could do compared to what we can do just 34 years later. And I mean, that trend continues, I think. They're just the technology that it just allows us to look at smaller and smaller and smaller units of living organisms, and by doing that, gain greater appreciation for the mechanisms by which toxic effects occur, and that being hardly any different from understanding how biology works, because you're perturbing processes and molecules and structures that have to be intact, and you have to, in order not to get toxic effects. So, I mean, you've got to understand the basic biology before you can understand the toxicology, by understanding what you're disrupting. So those three big changes there.
Anything I should have asked you that I've not yet asked you? About the history of the Institute, the history of genetic toxicology, changes in the environmental health sciences.
No, I don't think so. If there are, you'll think of
them. And I'll email you.
You'll be back. Or on the email, yeah.
Is it... And are there ways in which your career in environmental health science has been significantly similar, significantly different than what you imagined when you went off to get that PhD?
I didn't have an idea of where I was going then. I think there are people that have much better plans than I do. Mm-hmm. I just am a victim of the winds of fate, I think. I watch for opportunities. I try to make sure that what I do is done well. And one thing that I can just offer up without a question is that the reason that I'm where I am now instead of back in the laboratory of toxicology is that I had reached a stage in my life when I just felt like I needed to do something that had a more immediate health impact than overseeing 6 or 7 research groups and taking care of budgets and personnel problems and just organizational business. So, and the center here has allowed me to do that, and I have to say it's gratifying. I mean, I don't have many resources, human or otherwise, to oversee, but I've got enough to do the job that we set out to do. So, I was never a basic researcher at heart or in practice, but I was always concerned about public health issues, and the CERHR allows me to, in the twilight of my career, to do something that I can see the impact of, rather than saying, well, we'll do this and somewhere down the line it'll be useful to the people out there. Somebody will pick it up and do something with it. So I'm happy in what I'm doing now.
Which is great.
It's good, you bet.
What are the major projects that this CERHR are working on right now?
Well, we're just putting the final touches on the expert panel report on fluoxetine hydrochloride, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. you may know as Prozac,
mm-hmm.
and its possible impact on reproduction and development in humans.
Mm-hmm.
And a month from now, we've got an expert panel convening to do the same kind of evaluation on acrylamide,
mm-hmm.
which is recently in the news because it's found in French fries and
right.
yeah.
all sorts of fried foods, right?
Right, yeah, yeah, especially starchy foods mm-hmm. cooked at high temperatures. And it's already, it's known it's a rodent carcinogen, it's a neurotoxicant in mm-hmm. humans, it's a germ cell mutagen in rodents.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's a bad actor. But the amounts of this acrylamide in the diet are, by some measure, very, very small.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the challenge of the acrylamide expert panel is going to be more of one of drawing a conclusion about whether or not the levels we're exposed to, as best we understand them,
mm-hmm.
pose a risk or not.
What would the risk reduction strategy for acrylamide be? Don't eat french fries. I can't eat tuna.
Potato chips, right?
No, I can't eat french fries.
No, you have to forget all those wonderful dinners you had of french fries and tuna. I don't know. I mean, the food industry, right. I know, is already working on it.
Mm-hmm.
Putting things in or taking things out mm-hmm. or changing the cooking process or mm-hmm. something. It's not clear that it's even a risk at
mm-hmm.
this point. But,
mm-hmm.
It's got enough press. In fact, it was on the news this morning before I came in.
Mm-hmm.
But it becomes a dose issue now. Maybe the doses are low enough that it's not causing any mm-hmm. harm. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, those are the kinds of things we're doing.
Were you...